Chapter 5. The generator room of the James Bay Hydroelectric Project stunned the senses of Charles Sarva as he surveyed the 12 square acres carved out of solid granite 400 feet underground. Three rows of huge generators, five stories high and driven by water turbines, hummed with millions of kilowatts of electricity. Sarva was suitably impressed and displayed it to the pleasure of the Quebec hydropower directors. This was his first visit to the project since his election as Prime Minister of Canada, and he asked all the expected questions. How much electrical energy does each generator produce? Percival Stuckey, the chief director, stepped forward. 500,000 kilowatts, Prime Minister. Sarva nodded and made a slight facial expression of approval. It was the appropriate gesture, a skill that had proved beneficial during his campaign for office. A handsome man in the eyes of men as well as women, Sarva could probably have won a contest over John F. Kennedy or Anthony Eden. His light blue eyes possessed a mesmeric quality, and his sharp-cut facial features were enhanced by a thick mass of gray hair, loosely styled in a fashionable but casual look. His trim, medium-height body was a tailor's dream, and yet he never called upon the services of tailors, preferring to buy his suits off the racks of department stores. It was only one of many twists of character precisely carried off so Canadian voters could identify with him. A compromise candidate between the Liberals, the Party for Independent Canada, and the French-speaking Parti Québécois, he had walked a political tightrope his first 3 years of office, managing to keep his nation from falling apart at its provincial borders. Sarva looked upon himself as another Lincoln, fighting to preserve unity and keep his house from dividing. It was only his threat of armed force that kept the radical separatists in check. But his plea for a strong central government was falling on a growing sea of deaf ears. "Perhaps you would like to see the control center," suggested Director Stuckey. Sarva turned to his principal secretary. "How is our time?" Ian Jeffrey, a serious-faced man in his late 20s, checked his watch. "We're running tight, Prime Minister. We should be at the airport in 30 minutes. "I think we can squeeze our schedule," Sarva smiled. "It would be a pity if we missed anything worthwhile." Stuckey nodded and motioned toward an elevator door. 10 floors above the generator chamber, Sarva and his entourage stepped out in front of a door marked "Security Card Personnel Only." Stuckey removed a plastic card that hung on a cord around his neck and inserted it in a slot beneath the door handle. Then he turned and faced the others. "I'm sorry, gentlemen, but due to the narrow confines of the control center, I can only allow the Prime Minister and myself to enter." Sarva's security people started to protest, but he waved them to silence and followed Stuckey through the door and down a long corridor where the card process was repeated. The power plant's control center was indeed small, and spartan as well. 4 engineers sat in front of a console laced with a forest of lights and switches, peering at a panel of dials and gauges embedded in the facing wall. Except for a row of television monitors hanging from the ceiling, the only other fixtures were the chairs occupied by the engineers. Sarva looked around consideringly. "I find it incredible that such an awesome display of power is controlled by only 4 men and a modest amount of equipment." "The entire plant and the transmission stations are operated by computers 2 floors beneath us," explained Stuckey. "The project is 99% automated. What you see here, Mr. Sarva, is the 4th-level manual monitoring system that can override the computers in the event of a malfunction." "So humans still have a degree of control," Sarva smiled. "We're not obsolete quite yet," Stuckey smiled back. "There are a few areas left where electronic science can't be fully trusted." "Where does this wealth of power terminate?" "In a few days, when the project is fully operational, we'll service the whole of Ontario, Quebec, and the northeastern United States." A thought began to germinate in Sarva's mind. "And if the impossible occurred?" Stuckey looked at him.
"Sir?"
"A breakdown, an act of God, sabotage. Nothing short of a major earthquake could put the power facilities entirely out of commission. Isolated damage or breakdown can be bypassed by 2 safety backup systems. If those fail, we still have manual control here in the booth. What about an attack by terrorists? We've planned for exactly such a threat, said Stuckey confidently. Our electronic security system is a marvel of advanced technology, and we have a 500-man guard force to back it up. An elite division of assault troops couldn't reach this room in 2 months. Then someone here could cut the power. Not someone singular. Stuckey shook his head resolutely. It takes every man in this room, including myself, to close off the energy flow. Two, even three, cannot do it. We each have a separate procedure unknown to the others that is built into the systems. Nothing has been overlooked. Sarva wasn't so sure. He held out his hand. A most impressive tour. Thank you. Foss Gly had been meticulous in selecting the means and place for killing Charles Sarva. Every drawback, however remote, had been taken into account and met with a counteraction. The angle of the plane's ascent was carefully measured, as was its speed. Many long hours were spent in practice sessions until Gly was satisfied that the gears of the plot meshed with exacting precision. The site chosen was a golf course, 1 mile beyond the southwest end of the James Bay Airport's main runway. At that point, according to Gly's careful reckoning, the Prime Minister's government plane would have reached an altitude of 1,500 feet at a speed of 180 knots per hour. Two British-manufactured handheld Argo ground-to-air missile launchers, stolen from the Army arsenal at Val Jalbert, were to be used for the attack. They were compact, weighing 30 pounds each when loaded, and easily concealed in a hiker's backpack when dismantled. The entire plan, as calculated from start to finish, was a classic in efficiency. No more than 5 men were required, including 3 waiting on the golf course disguised as cross-country skiers, and 1 lookout on the observation balcony of the terminal building with a concealed radio transmitter. After the heat-seeking missiles were launched at the target, the attack group was to ski casually toward the deserted clubhouse and leave in a 4-wheel drive station wagon, guarded by the 5th man who would be waiting in the parking lot. Gly searched the sky with a pair of binoculars while his fellow conspirators assembled the launchers. A medium snow was falling, cutting his sight to 1/3 of a mile. It proved a mixed blessing. The white curtain would shield their actions but leave them precious few seconds to aim and fire at a fast-moving object during the brief interval when it was visible. A British Airways jet passed over, and Gly timed its passage before it was swallowed up by the weather. Barely 6 seconds. Not good, he thought grimly. Their chances of 2 direct hits were razor thin. He brushed the snow from a great mass of light sandy hair and lowered the binoculars, revealing a square, ruddy face. On first glance, it was attractive in a boyish way. There were congenial brown eyes and a firm-cut chin. But on closer inspection, it was the nose that upstaged the other features. Large and misshapen from numerous breaks suffered during brutal back-alley fights, it squatted between his cheeks with a strange beauty to its ugliness. For some inexplicable reason, women thought it attractive, even sexy. The tiny radio in the pocket of his down jacket beeped to life. "This is dispatch to Field Foreman." He pressed the transmit button. "Go ahead, dispatch." Claude Moran, a reed-thin, pockmarked Marxist, who worked as a secretary for the Governor-General, adjusted his earpiece receiver and began talking softly into a lapel microphone while gazing through the observation balcony window at the flight line below. "I have that load of pipe, Field Foreman. Are you ready to receive it?"
"Say when," replied Gly.
"The truck will be along shortly, as soon as the dock crew unloads a shipment from the States." The innocent-sounding conversation was contrived to throw off anyone who happened to be tuned to the same frequency. Gly interpreted Moran's double talk as meaning the Prime Minister's plane was second in line for takeoff behind an American Airlines passenger jet.
"Okay, dispatch, let me know when the truck leaves the dock."
Personally, Gly felt no hatred toward Charles Sarva. To him, the Prime Minister was only a name in the newspapers. Gly was not even Canadian. He was born in Flagstaff, Arizona, the result of a drunken coupling between a professional wrestler and a county sheriff's teenage daughter.
His childhood was a nightmare of suffering and whippings dealt by his grandfather. In order to survive, Gly became very strong and hard. The day came when he beat the sheriff to death and fled the state. After that, it had always been a fight to stay alive. He began by rolling drunks in Denver, led a ring of auto thieves in Los Angeles, hijacked gasoline tank trucks in Texas. Gly did not look upon himself as a mere assassin. He preferred to be called a coordinator. He was the man who was called in when all others failed, a leader of specialists. He had a reputation for cold-blooded efficiency. On the observation platform, Moran inched his face as close as he dared to the window before his breath fogged the glass. Sarva's aircraft appeared to be dissolving into the falling snow on the taxi lane leading to the start of the runway.
Field foreman.
Yes, dispatcher.
Sorry, but I cannot see my way clear of paperwork to give you an exact time for the pipe arrival.
Understood, Gly answered. Check with me after lunch. Moran did not acknowledge. He took the escalator down to the main lobby and walked outside, where he hailed a cab. In the back seat, he allowed himself the luxury of a cigarette and wondered what high appointment in the new Quebec government he should demand for his services. On the golf course, Gly turned to the men aiming the missile launchers. Their eyes were pressed against the sighting lenses as each kneeled on one knee in the snow.
One more takeoff to target, he cautioned them.
Nearly 5 minutes dragged by before Gly heard a set of jet engines roaring in the distance as they strained to lift their burden off the snowy asphalt. His eyes tried to penetrate the white wall in anticipation of seeing the red and blue insignia of the American airliner flash into view. Too late, it dawned on him that aircraft belonging to heads of state took preference over commercial flights. Too late, the sight of the familiar red and white Canadian maple leaf burst through the blanket of snow.
"It's Sarva!" he shouted. "Fire, for God's sake, fire!"
The two men pressed their firing buttons no more than a second apart. The first jerked his sights in the general direction of the plane, but his missile soared up and arched too far behind the tail structure for its heat-seeking mechanism to lock on target. The second man fired with more deliberation. He led the cockpit windows by 100 yards before he let loose. The explosive head, locking onto the exhaust of the outer starboard engine, homed in and struck aft of the turbine. To the men on the ground, it seemed the muted explosion came long after the plane had vanished from sight. They waited for the sounds of a crash, but the fading whine of the engines remained unbroken. Quickly, they dismantled the launchers and skied to the parking lot. They were soon mingling with the southbound traffic on the James Bay-Ottawa Highway. The outboard engine burst into flame, and the turbine blades broke loose and sprayed through the cowling, striking the inboard engine like shrapnel, slicing fuel lines and mangling the second stage compressor. Inside the cockpit, the fire warning bell sounded, and the pilot, Ray Emmett, closed the throttle and pushed the button activating the Freon fire extinguishers. His co-pilot, Jack May, began running through the emergency procedure checklist.
"James Bay Tower, this is Canada One. We have a problem here and are turning back," Emmett said in a calm monotone.
"Are you declaring an emergency?" the controller asked routinely.
"Affirmative."
"We will clear runway 24. Can you make standard approach?"
"Negative, James Bay," answered Emmett. "I have two engines out, one on fire. I suggest you get out equipment."
"Fire rescue equipment rolling, Canada One. You are cleared to land. Good luck."
The men in the control tower, knowing the pilot of Canada One was under severe stress, would not break his concentration with further talk. They could only stand by helplessly and await the outcome. The aircraft was stalling, and Emmett eased its nose down, increasing the airspeed to 210 knots, and turned into a wide, shallow bank. Fortunately, the snow lessened and visibility rose to 2 miles, and he could see the flat farmland below and the beckoning end of the runway. Back in the aft executive cabin, the two Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who guarded the Prime Minister 24 hours a day, went into action as soon as they felt the impact from the missile. They secured belted Sarva to his seat and began building a mountain of loose cushions around his body. Up forward, his secretarial staff and the ever-present contingent of news reporters
stared nervously at the smoldering engine that looked as though it was about to melt off the wing. The hydraulic system was lost. May switched to manual. The pilot struggled together with the stiffened controls as the ground relentlessly reached up from below. Even at full throttle, the two port engines were hard-pressed to hold the giant airliner aloft. They were falling past the 600-foot level now, and still Emmett did not lower the landing gear, holding until the last possible moment to maintain what precious airspeed he still had. The plane passed over the green belt surrounding the airport. It was going to be close. At 200 feet, Emmett dropped the wheels. Through the metronome sweep of the windshield wipers, the 10,000-foot ribbon of runway 24 seemed to widen in slow motion. Then they swept over the leading lip of the asphalt, the tires no more than 6 feet from the ground. Emmett and May pulled the control yoke back with all their strength. A gentle landing would have been a miracle. Any landing at all was a wonder. The impact came hard, jarring every rivet in the aluminum skin and blowing 3 tires. The shattered starboard engine broke free of its mounts, and in a freakish gyration struck the ground and rebounded against the underside of the wing, ripping through the structural elements and gouging into the outer fuel cell. 5,000 gallons of jet fuel burst into a ball of flame that engulfed the right side of the aircraft. Emmett threw the 2 good engines into reverse thrust and fought the plane's tendency to yaw to the left. Bits and pieces of rubber from the blown tires flayed away in shredded frenzy. 30 feet of the blazing wing spun off and hurtled onto a taxi lane, narrowly missing a parked airliner. Not far behind, the fire trucks charged after the plane, sirens and red lights flashing. Down the runway, the dying plane rolled, like a fiery meteor leaving a tail of burning debris. Flames tore at the fuselage, which began to melt away. Inside, the heat grew to inferno proportions. The passengers were seconds away from burning alive as the insulation began to char, and clouds of smoke swirled down the aisle. One of the Mounties pulled open the emergency door opposite the fire, while the other unclasped the Prime Minister's safety belt and unceremoniously shoved him toward the opening. Ahead, in the main compartment over the wing, people were dying, their clothes smoldering as the intense heat seared their lungs. Ian Jeffrey staggered screaming into the cockpit before he fell unconscious to the floor. Emmett and May took no notice. They were too busy fighting to keep the disintegrating plane on a straight course as it thundered down the rapidly diminishing runway. The Mounties popped the emergency escape chute, but it flapped uselessly toward the tail of the aircraft after a piece of red-hot debris punctured its air sac. They turned and saw with horror that the forward bulkhead was torching itself into oblivion. Frantically, one of them snatched a blanket and wrapped it around Sarva's head. "Hold on to it!" he yelled. Then he heaved the Prime Minister through the hatch. The blanket saved Sarva's life. He landed on a shoulder, dislocating it, and cartwheeled across the coarse surface of the runway, the blows about his head absorbed by the blanket. His legs splayed out and the left tibia twisted and snapped. He tumbled nearly 30 meters before skidding to a stop, his suit shredded in tatters that slowly stained crimson from a mass of skin abrasions. Emmett and May died at the controls. They died with 42 other men and 3 women as 200 tons of aircraft erupted into a fiery coffin of orange and red. The forward momentum of the great shaft of flame scattered wreckage over a quarter of the runway. The firefighters attacked the Holocaust, but the tragedy was finished. Soon the blackened skeleton of the plane was buried under a sea of white foam. Asbestos-suited men probed the smoldering remains, forcing down the bile that rose in their throats when they came across roasted forms that were barely recognizable as human. Sarva, dazed and in shock, lifted his head and stared at the disaster. At first the paramedics did not identify him. Then one kneeled and studied his face.
"Holy Mother Mary," he gasped, "it's the Prime Minister."
Sarva tried to answer, tried to say something meaningful, but no words came. He closed his eyes and gratefully accepted the blackness that enveloped him.